Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotrick are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotrick.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60. And I thank Velotrick for being a sponsor on this show. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Schmel, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this horrifically named podcast series. But what we care about is the Q&A. That QA at the end of the title stands obviously for the questions and the answers as we try to dig a little bit more into these tech news topics. That's why I like to hold them a podcast on a Monday. Give us a little time to kind of sort out the news from the last week. Maybe some news broke over the weekend, and we can kind of keep up with things better than just reading some headlines on social media and getting outraged. Kapikosh, thank you. I was just going to do a mic check. Audio is being really funky on my system right now. So, We're in for another potential calamity episode. Who knows? I was kind of like jamming like with all of like the pre-show music, and then it just cut out. And like, I have no idea if that's just me or if that's what y'all are hearing. So, y'all telling me the mic is great. I'm gonna roll with it, and we're just gonna jump right in. We've got a lot of news, and I'd also really like to use the sort of second half of this podcast to chat out. There's a trend that we're seeing in how we talk about gadgets and sort of. How phone sales are going and consumers just sort of generally feeling a little apathetic towards, you know, new phones with exciting new features, but really they're not that exciting. So when we get kind of into that gadget block, especially because I think a number of us here are kind of photo nerds. I think there's going to be something meaty for us to kind of dig into, something for us to chat about. We have an incredible list of familiar faces and names here in the chat already. Seeing Dave Burns, I'm seeing Barry Johnson, Lamprose, Cedric. Hey, what's up, Cedric? Michael Corcoran, J-Man150, I said Barry Johnson, T-Bubs, Kapikosh, Michael Corcoran, Gwendolyn. Hey, Gwendolyn saying, hi, y'all, and what up, Barry? We got Ron Guido, we've got Kapikosh, we got J-Man, we got Paco Stilandbit, Carib. No, my scroll just went crazy. My computer is in a weird place right now. this workstation is definitely keeping me on my toes. What you look I at? I saw Caribou. Where's Caribou? I'm sorry. Oh, Caribou Rotor. Just saying hello, all. Hello, Caribou. Dave Burns, when are you replacing your machine with mini PCs? Okay, so that is a very good question that has already immediately sidetracked housekeeping and the entire podcast, because I do have a plan. I have this monstrous workstation. It's a Threadripper with a 4070 Ti in a humongous case. And I am actively looking at retiring it and seeing if I can go to a much simpler video production setup here in my office. Something where I don't have to have a massive server case under my desk, and I can have like a little cute, like maybe Windows on ARM machine on top of my desk. And that way, if I need to run like, hey, I want to run a little mini PC to host, say, an audio town hall. And then that PC can send and receive audio, but it connects to a live streaming video editing PC, and both of them on my desk, operating well below the power requirements of a Threadripper and a 4070 Ti. That's the grand plan. That's what I really want to make happen. And then I can get rid of so many cables on my desk and under my desk that I can actually use my standing desk to stand. Maybe even just completely get rid of any kind of gaming chair here in my office, and I can walk around and be a bit more mobile. So that's the grand hope, that by the end of 2024, I'll have retired the monster under this desk. So, Dave, you're not far off the pulse. That is something I really want to do. Let me take a little drink of coffee here. We have a lot of housekeeping to chew through. So hold on, one second. Okay. So last week was actually surprisingly busy. I only got two things published publicly, but I also front-loaded quite a bit on the Patreon. And we've talked about in the past just kind of the ebb and flow of what's going on with YouTube, watching another series of creators. We talked about Warner Brothers Discovery last week or the week before, shutting down like Rooster Teeth and something else. Adult Swim games, like in the same week. And then MatPat retired from the Theories channel, like Film Theory and Game Theory, and I watched his last Film Theory just talking about boys and role models and media, and like, actually, that was a really insightful video. That there were those gems that I used to tune in far more frequently, but it was also just kind of the end of an era, and I wanted to see the last video. And the burnout is real. Channels are kind of getting shut down left and right, or people are walking away to try and do other things. Think of all of the tech reporters and I don't want to use the word influencers, but commentators and reviewers that we've lost over the last couple of years. And it's kind of the community at Patreon that is almost single-handedly keeping some gadget guy operating. So that has to become a bit more of the priority, but I am working to find a more equitable share for when content goes there, maybe there's an early access, and then when it gets put out publicly. So I don't have the recipe yet. I think everyone in the chat would admit I'm doing this very poorly, but I am trying to find something that works for everybody, and it doesn't feel like one group is getting all the attention and other people are getting ostracized. So, Dave Burns, I guess we gotta bully you harder. You haven't gotten rid of me yet, Dave. I'm still, like the skin of my fingertips, I'm still holding on. Oh, Michael Corcoran, that could be fun. Juan should make a horror movie where the villain is the algorithm. Wasn't there a terrible movie on Netflix? Was it on Netflix? I think it was called like Cam. It's about the adult industry and when a performer starts getting really popular, this software like takes over her likeness and tries to hijack her audience. I want to say, I hope I didn't make that up in my brain. Someone please tell me if that's a real movie. Let's knock out some housekeeping before I get demonstrably hijacked yet again. So, published last week, I don't like this feeling. I occasionally have to dip my toe into the salacious waters of trendy outrage, or of like response videos, or in reacting to a review. And lately you've seen like I've really worked against trying to call out bigger reviewers for what I feel are very lazy review trends, because really all it does is popularize what little audience I can generate, just goes to popularize the even bigger channel, and they get more outrage traffic and they profit from that. So the other side of this is just how disastrous social media has been over the last couple years. And I tried to cover this in a written editorial. Reddit is looking to do an IPO. It's probably coming down the pipe pretty soon. And I could not find a newsy angle. I how to cover it, just the facts, try and keep my own personal bias and emotions out of it. But I have such a long history with trying to support and contribute to communities on platforms like Reddit that I really couldn't. I wrote this editorial three times, and by the third, it's maybe the most... It's sort of the softest flavor. I mean, like, each version of the editorial kind of wound down. Like, I had to exercise some of my demons and expunge some of my bile. But I got to the third one, and it's still more of a personal opinion piece than it is any kind of articulate news coverage. And I got to the end, and I'm like, you know what? I kind of need to title this editorial something fitting. So the title of this editorial is Reddit's IPO, I Hope It Fails, because that's how I feel. And I lay out my thoughts on what it means to sort of participate on social media and how platforms take advantage of those people that actually supply the content. And increasingly, and this is the thing I don't understand, increasingly, social media platforms are also hostile to the advertisers that are funding the social media platform. So I don't understand why any company would choose to advertise on a platform like Reddit or even on YouTube when one of the major hooks for YouTube and Reddit participants, the viewers, is you can pay to disable ads. If I see a platform saying, don't you think ads are annoying? We think they're annoying too, so just pay us $6 a month, $8 a month. A family plan is now like $30 a month. I don't know what it really is. And now you can get rid of those pesky and intrusive ads. Would you have any faith as an advertiser that your ads were actually getting linked up with appropriate customers who might be interested in your products and services? Why would you pay money for that? I don't get it. I really don't. So that's kind of the crux of this editorial, is just this stuff is deeply personal. We build friendships and communities and platforms, and we help people. Been involved in like high-minded debates on philosophy as much as I've also just like, you know, argued about nuance in animation and what album is coming out. By the way, Norah Jones' new album, absolute banger. Absolute banger. Lex and I have been jamming to it. It's got such a really good 70s vibe. The production is very clever. It's very sweet, and it feels like old-fashioned in that way that I love artists that really emulate sort of the period that they're kind of recording in. And I, you know, from Norah Jones being the artist that you would see on CD case covers in a Starbucks to being just like every album of hers is like unique and fresh and on a pulse that I didn't know I needed to listen to. So anyway, highly recommend Norah Jones, really good. Moving on, the other major public, nope, come on, there we go. The other major review that came out is, I've been playing with this Unihertz. I know all of my brethren are out there like, hey, here's this really fancy, expensive, like super awesome camera phone. And the folks at Unihertz reached out and said, hey, would you want to play around with a Tank? So I said yes, because I have not experienced anything like this before, and I just wanted to play with something kind of wacky. The Tank 3, and you know, I have a full review, so I'm not going to recover all of the review here, but the Tank 3 has almost every single technology we've ever put into a phone before in one package, and combined with an absurdly large almost 24,000 milliamp hour battery power bank that can also sort of slow charge other small gadgets. And it's ridiculous. I mean, I've got a thumbnail with absurd question mark in big letters. This is not a phone. This is a portable communication appliance for people who might want some kind of weekender hiking, backpacking, literally, it'll last 5 days out in the field kind of device. So I had to play. I've got a lot of thoughts and a lot of questions, and this is probably the phone that has injured me the worst. Was crouching to take a photo. I talk about this in the video. I was crouching to take a photo, and I show the photo. It's these like gnarled tree, dead tree trunks that have been sawed down. in my neighborhood. And I was getting up, and I did something really stupid. I was holding on to it like a camera, big, flat, chunky sides. It's really easy to hold it like a camera. And I let go of one hand, and I went to flip the phone, just like any other phone. You know, like you go from holding it like a camera to holding it phone in one hand. And it completely slipped right out of my hand. And my instinct, which is so dumb, I went to try and catch it with my foot. So this thing weighs, 700 grams? 710, something, somewhere in there. I go to catch it with my foot, which basically means I'm kicking this block of battery, and I'm just wearing tennis shoes, and man, this thing, like, corner just punches me right in the top of the foot. And it hurts so bad. It was so bad. Yeah, Simon says, no, it's the Swiss Army Claymore of phones. Yeah, that's not a knife. That's a knife. I'm so sorry I made that reference. Yeah, Dave Burns, the Unihertz Battle Club, now with 30% more advantage to bludgeoning damage. My foot can definitely attest to the accuracy of that statement. So, those are the two big public videos. I've got a couple other Patreon things to highlight here in early access. I've got a OnePlus 12 versus Pixel 8 Pro showdown. Now, I've spent some time living with both. And again, some of you might be able to predict what my general conclusion is between these two devices. But we got a nice little video that I can kind of point out some pros and cons and some comparisons between the two. Then we're going to be talking about this later on. This is what I was sort of alluding to. Were point and shoot cameras as good as we remember them? Fight for blood! And we've got an article that we're going to talk about, a sharp rise in used camera sales. And influencers are really digging on this old school digital camera aesthetic. So this article actually does kind of go back and forth with some photo samples and some comparisons between one of my old point-and-shoot cameras that I happened to find in a box in my storage, and the Vivo X100 Pro, which, funnily enough, the timing on this is kind of perfect because I finally finished my Vivo X100 Pro camera deep dive. 34 minutes of me basically praising Vivo for having probably not the best camera of the year, probably not the best pro or ultra tier camera, what amounts to an incredible premium tier camera that stays in a slightly more accessible price range. And what Vivo is accomplishing sub ultra tier pricing is nothing short of remarkable. It is so far been the main camera you've seen in almost all of my B-roll. And in some of my like studio shots, I'm not even setting up. Like I've got my Lumix over here on a microphone stand, of all things. You haven't been seeing my fancy mirrorless cameras in any of this B-roll. The Vivo is going toe-to-toe with Micro Four Thirds. So it's pretty remarkable. And if you needed... if you need it, there's 34 minutes of me saying, yeah, this is kind of the best bang for buck camera I've ever seen. And it's kind of fun to say that, you know, even if you're repeating yourself. There are a couple sticky bits. Still, it's Vivo. It's a really messy camera app. But the criticisms, I think, all kind of into a specific charm in a very Sony-like way, where it's like, once you know what you're getting, it is a very specific kind of conversation. So I'm really proud of this one. This one came out really well. I'm going to do a cut down, just the camera conclusion, and put that up on YouTube. But the bits of this one, I had a lot of fun because I also didn't have a ton of samples. You know, you spend a lot of time reviewing phones and you fall into this pattern, and you fall into this trap. I'm going to get this new phone. I'm going to take it out into the neighborhood. I'm going to shoot these trees. I'm going to shoot this rock outcropping. I'm going to shoot these flowers. Then I'm going to talk about all the pretty colors in the HDRs. And I did a lot of that with the Vivo too, but so much of what I'm shooting on the Vivo is actual practical work stuff. So like, the amount of product photography and product video samples that I have from this phone is kind of ridiculous. And so that's a good chunk of what's actually populating my review, is pointing back and saying like, hey, remember this battery I reviewed? That was shot from the Vivo. Hey, you remember all of the other phones on my desk? All of them were shot from the Vivo. The only thing the Vivo is not good at is taking photos of itself. And if I had two, then I would absolutely do that thing. And I got to take a quick pause here. McCorkerin3, subscribed to Prime for 31 months. Now let's see if I can give you the fanfare of glory. Let's see. Does not seem to be playing. Well, let me try one more time. See, that's what borked. Okay, so McCorkerin, unfortunately, I think we have discovered what broke on my audio setup. So, thank you for your support. You get the old school. I really appreciate it. And again, all of the support, all of the contributions, and people joining these conversations and sharing these podcasts and videos and articles. It's what helps keep us little YouTubers and reviewers and commentators afloat in a sea of very scary tech topics and news stories. Yeah, we got a couple people just mentioning some stuff on Michael Corcoran saying, I remember Tech Preacher said the Tank 2 had better pictures, but that might have been picked an update. It's a Unihertz? I don't know that we're really leaning on updates for a Unihertz. Unihertz is an appliance. You buy it in the state that it arrives at, and if it happens to get any kind of polish, that is like such a wonderful additional little icing on top of the cake that you have to know that you're buying. So I would not be putting any faith into what it might be like after you've owned it for a while. Some other folks talking about rugged phones and Doji. Yeah, and some of them are inexpensive. Like Michael Corcoran is saying, Doji S Mini looks pretty compelling for $199. I really feel like this is an underserved product category now, especially with the way that Kyocera dialed back. So anyway. Gormlord says, I still have the music going. I don't think that's what's affecting it. I was just going to let the music run. Do you all like not like the music, or should I cut the music? I don't know. I was just kind of let it jam. So anyway, this audio setup is stupid complicated, by the way, to get audio in on one computer to then send to a web distribution platform that eventually makes it to like Twitch and YouTube with a mic that also needs to be inserted and summed. You would think that we would have a mixer that could handle stuff like that, and it doesn't. None of them work. I was trying the Rode, I was trying cable audio, virtual audio, I was trying OBS plugins, everything. It is what it is. So I just kind of thought, you know, hey, let the sort of background music play from the intro, and I don't know, I kind of like the lounge channel on Restream. So anyway, that is going to wrap us up for housekeeping. We've got a pretty healthy news block to get through. Let me get this out of the way, get that right there. So everything that we're going to be talking about, all of the show notes, all of the housekeeping, and all of the articles, everything will be linked in this week's podcast post on somegadgetguy.com. Especially for you folks in the replay crew, always love folks in the replay crew, and those of you who are sharing and reviewing podcasts on your favorite podcast apps and services and platforms. Every little bit helps. It's what the little efforts that we see from week to week to week help bring some more new people in here, find some new audience, find some new listeners, and that's how we keep these conversations rolling. Let me get this right here. Oh, Michael Corcoran saying, hey, Juan, have you got in touch with Nothing? If they were smart, they would get you that neck band. I did see it spring up on eBay, but it's not officially out in the USA yet. And it's going to be like $40. I'm just going to buy one. I mean, I would like to be... So again, we mentioned this on Best of Our Week. I don't have anything against Nothing. I think they're making some really fine phones, but so much of what they're putting into their design aesthetic is not what I'm looking for in a phone. And I don't want to be on the hook for reviewing a bunch of their gadgets to then say, like, this is a phone I'm never going to use, or this is a phone that's not really for me, or it's another really good mid-ranger in a sea of really good mid-rangers where I can get more excited about, like, the Zeiss collaboration on a Vivo, or the camera capabilities on a Pixel. It's that kind of stuff that makes it really tricky for me to reach out and say, hey, I'd like to play with your products, but I'm probably not going to review them that well. So I don't know. But seeing a good neckband, I'm always interested in playing with a good neckband. So as soon as it's available to purchase in the United States, I'll just buy one. I'll just buy one and I'll probably throw up a quick and dirty review on the Patreon first and then have that go broad. But yeah, and anytime we see like good audio products in a company that seems invested in giving us a form factor like a neckband Bluetooth audio kit, we have to highlight that. We have to shout it out. It's mission critical, and we really want to see what those things can do. Hold on one second. Let me get another drink of coffee here. Okay. If we have FCC news or sort of government or policy or regulator news, I like to start off with that. And we don't have to spend a ton of time on this one because I want to say it was almost a year ago now. A while back. I have no idea in what episode number we might have talked about this. I'm so bad at keeping track of my own podcast. We covered the open comments request for the FCC to start reclassifying broadband. Not in terms of Title I, Title II, but in terms of what could a company offer that should be called high-speed broadband. And the United States classification for high, you if you can sell this, then you can call your service high-speed broadband was 25 megabits per second downloads and 3 megabit per second uploads. Basically maxing out the capabilities of most regions for DSL. And we've still been calling that high-speed broadband. I believe everyone in this chat, leave a zero in chat if you think 25 down, 3 up is worthy of being called high-speed broadband. But we did open public comments, and we had a couple of politicians. We had a couple senators, actually, that were advocating for reclassification of matched download and upload. Some going as far as saying you shouldn't be able to call something high-speed broadband unless it's symmetrical, 100 down, 100 up. And I was so excited for that because cable, for a lot of the regions here in the United States, cable broadband is asymmetrical. It's always been prioritizing your download and consumption and minimizing your ability to upload. So we've got all of these like, oh, you can go and get Comcast gigabit internet. Not really. It's kind of like 900 down, 30 up. And if we think about all of these people who make these BS arguments about like free speech on the internet, you have to be a free speech absolutist. We literally have an economy in the United States where the majority of people who have access to any kind of broadband, the majority of them can consume, what is that, 30 times more garbage than they can contribute good ideas to the internet. You can literally consume 5 times more junk with a 120 split than you can upload better ideas to fight disinformation and misinformation and obviously manufactured, strategically weaponized social media content. I am of the mind that if we can't upload as aggressively as we can download, then we don't have sort of a fair, open, free speech tech society. I advocated and I requested that people write letters to the FCC. And I wrote a complaint to the FCC and I asked them to investigate. And unfortunately, the FCC has gone with a sweetheart deal to current cable providers. So what I'll be linking in the show notes is directly to the PDF, not to an article or an editorial about this. This is the official press release. FCC increases broadband speed benchmark and what they're going to switch. And they're so, like, the thing I hate about this is, like, they're patting themselves on the back at putting a label on sort of the lowest tier of what we already have. So the official broadband classification beforehand was 25 down, 3 up. The new classification is 100 megabits per second down and 20 megabits per second up, which again, in the vast majority of people that have cable broadband, that's kind of what you can get with cable. So Comcast and Spectrum, they don't have to do anything to change up their service or improve their service or work to bring United States citizens into a 21st century economy. And you've heard me whine about this in the past too. We have paid for and subsidized and paid fees and given sweetheart deals and tax breaks and zoning to all of these companies to give us fiber to home and more competitive communications technology. And it's never materialized. I mean, like, I'm now... Hold on, I want to try and do the math in my head. I think I'm almost 15 years in California from the first time I saw an open town hall call for public comments on investigating the potential of rolling fiber broadband to neighborhoods in Los Angeles. And we're still in the phase of, well, I think we need to investigate the business ramifications of giving people fiber, which should have been investigated 10 years ago. And there is no argument against it. And especially when we look at like the OE saying, hey, if you want to fix some of the issues with our infrastructure and with our electrical grid, and you want a better platform for things like EVs and smart power, you've got a smart home, but it's the smartness of your home stops at the electrical outlets because our energy grid is so antiquated. But if you want to improve those capabilities, the first way to do it is to start plugging homes into faster data. And that's not going to work with 100 megabits down and 20 megabits up. Again, your ability to consume garbage is 5 times better than your ability to upload better information to combat that garbage. So it's a really disappointing turn. I really feel the FCC has failed this year, and this was only so that they wouldn't they wouldn't face any kind of distinct challenge or lawsuit from cable companies. It definitely finally puts the cap on DSL. So now if you're AT&T, now AT&T has an incentive to start pushing more fiber because they don't have a copper cable solution in a lot of these markets. But again, it's so that you can't call it high-speed broadband. They're not going to care, and their customers aren't going to have, magically, they aren't going to have a competitive option. If you live in an area where the only thing you can get is DSL, you just lose the high-speed broadband moniker. Still going to be the same. No one's going to go rolling in there to say, oh, but we've got the high-speed broadband. So it doesn't help. It's literally just what label you can put on the box. And that's not very impressive to work this hard to change the definition and arrive at something that's already kind of mediocre for a lot of regions.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Let's see. Yeah, Dave Burns gave us a zero in chat saying, yeah, this gets crippled in dense housing. Muppinish is saying 25 megabytes a second is super fast. So what is that? 25, that's 200. Yeah, it's 200 megabits per second. But if you have 25 megabytes per second, that would be awesome. Most Americans don't have that. See, Vazicos, this is what's killing me. I would gladly pay for less download to get more upload. Vazico says, I have symmetrical 100 up and down, and it's a special kind of freedom. Yes, I have 20 megabits per second up. I'm uploading 4K video to the internet. My Vivo X100 Pro deep dive, the camera review, what is that? That's an 18 gigabyte file, and it took half a day. It took like 4 hours to upload it to half a business day. it took like 4 or 5 hours to upload that to YouTube. It's pretty awful. If I could quadruple that speed, I would be in much better position. Yeah, Simon says, no, money for nothing, but the clicks ain't free. And also, data caps are disgusting. We definitely agree there, Vazicos. I'm with you, Dave. I'm becoming radicalized in making the internet a completely total public utility. A lot of this should be publicly owned because it's been publicly paid for. And every time they complain, oh, but we can't do this infrastructure. You just need to give us more tax dollars. But don't regulate us. Oh, free market. Nah, I'm kind of over that, and I'm going to be actively, excuse me, ooh, that cough came out of nowhere. I'm going to be actively writing letters to my Congress representatives and my senators saying, in the future, I will only be supporting candidates that are now starting to take a tougher approach to broadband regulation and how we do business globally as a telecommunications entity. Let's see. Oh, and Michael, you're making some great points. I'm going to skip over them, but definitely be reading some of Michael's comments right there. Wes was my producer at Newegg. You told me how much you loved the internet speed at Newegg, so I had them hook you up. No, Wes, I was telling you how terrible it was. Oh, what a terrible miscommunication. Oh, gosh. You would think again. Like a massive tech retailer like YouTube trying to put out incredible video live streaming and trying to make really good content. Not great. not a great internet hookup at Newegg, which I don't think would be surprising to a lot of people. Now, one of the things that you can do with excellent broadband capabilities, of course, is consume and distribute adult materials. That's kind of one of the main functions of the internet, unless you live in Texas. Wah, 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 wah. Yes. So, this is coming by way of Ars Technica, written up by my nerd crush, John Brodkin. Pornhub blocks all of Texas to protest state law. Paxton says, good riddance. Pornhub has disabled its website in Texas following a court ruling that upheld a state law requiring age verification systems on adult websites. Visitors to thepornhub.com in Texas are now greeted with a message calling the Texas law ineffective, haphazard, and dangerous. Quote, as you may know, your elected... Oh, come on, I want to highlight this. As you may know, your elected officials in Texas are requiring us to verify your age before allowing you access to our website. Not only does this impinge on the rights of adults to access protected speech, it fails strict scrutiny by employing the least effective and yet also most restrictive means of accomplishing Texas's stated purpose of allegedly protecting minors. And, the Texas Attorney General just says, good riddance. Sites like Pornhub are on the run because Texas has a law that aims to prevent them from showing harmful obscene material to children. We recently secured a major victory against Pornhub and other sites that sought to block this law from taking effect. In Texas, companies cannot get away with showing adult materials to children if they don't want to comply. Good riddance. So, yeah. I think one of the major problems is, like, the system by which Texas has constructed they're set up to try and verify ages is it sounds pretty terrible. Where you've got to upload like photos of your driver's license to a state-run internet service, and that always goes really well, especially in an area like Texas, where boy howdy do they not put good money towards that kind of digital infrastructure management or anything like that. So I'm kind of, again, in the same way that I was very skeptical of Apple's policy of building a back door into the iPhone so that they wouldn't have to pay more server costs on scanning for abusive materials, this is yet another one where it's like, I think this is just a punitive action on behalf of Texan politicians, where they also then get to keep a database of every Texan citizen who might be engaged in some spicy extracurricular activities.
Well, the only reason for you to upload your photo to see this material is if you're one of those perverts, you see.
And I very much disagree with their management of this situation and their attempts at sort of reining in this. I don't disagree with sort of a general sentiment that we need to be mindful and we need to be conscious of how services spread and how we miss the educational opportunities to help kids with these very difficult concepts. Here in the United States, especially when we talk about kids growing up and learning about reproductive health, unfortunately, because of so many school districts kind of curtailing good educational opportunities for that kind of discussion, those kids are more inclined and more likely to start seeking out adult materials that are ridiculous fantasy. I mean, there's nothing realistic about the depictions of reproduction in these videos, but in an absence of better information, what are we left with? That's all they have. So it's, again, it kind of, in the way that it kind of goes back to the previous story, you wanted to try and craft more reasonable education on this kind of topic for children. It's very difficult to upload higher quality content to that discussion as it is to download the ridiculous, fantastic, imagination-y depictions of reproduction that you are apt to find on a site like thepornhub.com. So this is yet another one where I'm not particularly impressed with the court's position on this kind of stance. We'll have to see. We'll have to see how far this goes, whether or not this law in Texas will make it to the Supreme Court, and then how much faith we have in the Supreme Court to rule on this in sort of a fair or adequate manner, given the legalities of this case. But I think Texas is kind of overreaching. I think Pornhub's response is probably the best solution that they have, is literally just pull the plug on it, because at that point, we're going to see VPN access just launch. So, you know, if you're in Texas, what we should be doing right now is we should be tracking how many people are installing VPNs in Texas. And I think that would give us a good kind of overview on what the state of the consumption of this media really looks like, and how ineffective this kind of policy is when we're talking about state lawmakers to be like, no, this is a bad thing, and babies can't have steak because they don't have teeth to chew it, so no one can buy steak. Yeah, I kind of butchered that last metaphor joke. But yeah, I'll be really curious to see how this one plays out. So check the article, Ars Technica, John Brodkin wrote it up, and he's got links to a couple other similar rulings too. So he's got the links to other court cases that have kind of been discussed as precedent for how we might be managing this stuff in the future. So, Dave Burns has a pair of comments here. Hold on real quick. Surgeon General under Reagan, who was a devout Christian, recommended sexual education starting at fifth grade because of the AIDS epidemic. And Dave, and how many more people are now accessing Pornhub in Colorado? I'm telling you, like, it's one of those things where, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be a good look for the VPN company to be like, oh no, a bunch of people in Texas are using VPNs, but it would be a pretty good ad campaign to be like, hey, so Politicians are trying to shut you down, huh? I thought Texas was all about, like, freedom and rootin' tootin'. Oh well, I guess you guys suck now. Sure would be terrible for all them Texan politicians if you found out that there was some kind of service that could make it look like you were browsing the internet from another location. This podcast not brought to you by a VPN provider. At some point I should like reach out to Surfshark and be like, hey, give me a promo code and I'll just put that in one of my ad blocks on the podcast. Moving on, in yet other disastrous news that we can kind of have a little bit of a chuckle at, I think this car market has been wild to follow. So we had like a whole bunch of chip shortages during the pandemic. We were hearing about fleets of vehicles that couldn't be finished. Car prices started skyrocketing. We've been dealing with a ton of inflation. Our money has gone. How do I want to say that? Our money has never gone shorter. You know, you say like the value of a dollar goes farther, and now it's the opposite. So, this is an interesting indicator of seeing EVs, the ebb and flow of interest in EVs kind of cycle. And funnily enough, I caught this article first. I caught the story first from Notebook Check, written up by Daniel Zlatev. Used car prices fall most on record as Hertz CEO ousted over drastic Model 3 depreciation. Tesla now beats those typical vehicle price depreciation champions that hail from Italy, like Maserati and Alfa Romeo, in a rather unfortunate ranking of the value its used cars lost over the span of a year. Used Tesla cars lost nearly 30% of their value since last February, as Elon Musk kept cutting prices of new vehicles in order to stay competitive. So, Hertz, Rent-A-Car, bought into a humongous fleet of Teslas, over 100,000 Teslas at their peak, back when, like, Model 3s were going for top dollar. The average price that they spent was over $50,000, and now repair costs are killing them, and the average price is now lower in like the mid, oh, it's right here in the article, $36,000. So they went from an average sales price of $51,000 to an average sales price of $36,000. They've now been hosting a fire sale to get rid of Model 3s that have kind of reached the end of their operational duty as rental vehicles, starting at $16,000 if you tack on the federal used EV tax credit. That is a substantial drop. I mean, just think about like picking up a used Tesla for like $16,000. I don't think I'd want, considering how interestingly assembled Teslas are and how expensive they can be to repair, I don't think I'd want to buy a used Tesla that had been flogged as some kind of rental car. That's not my speed. But someone who's maybe a little bit more daring, or someone who's willing to like say, hey, I'm going to buy it for 16, but then know that I'm going to put more money into repairing it, that is an incredible starting price for an EV. So this is, dang it, I'm trying to catch these little mini, these. I got this like little dry spot in the back of my throat. Let me drink some water. Instead of coffee, I'm going to drink some water, see if I can just kind of loosen this up here a bit. I don't know that really helped, but it's been interesting to see. We've seen China scale up EV production, but then also in a way that's kind of been disastrous for their own EV economy, where we've been hearing those stories too about like fields of electric vehicles just getting built to not be sold. And their industries are kind of subsidized to a certain degree. So internationally, and especially in trying to compete in China, I understand, like, hey, let's cut prices, let's see if we can make the Tesla more attractive, you know, see if we can get more of them driving around in China, and people will be excited about that. That might work for the short term, But what we've seen, especially recently in gadget land and in EV land, is there's been kind of a social push for Chinese citizens to support Chinese companies. And there's something fun about owning something different or owning something a little bit more exclusive, like an iPhone or a Sony Xperia or a Tesla. But increasingly, the vast majority of the push, it looks better as a citizen of China, and especially for a country that grades you on your social score if you're supporting Chinese industry. So anyone who's going into China right now thinking that you're really going to tap into this huge market of potential consumers, you might find this little bubble of success in being sort of an alternative, but you're never going to long-term last. And the more your products are sold in that region, the more it's likely that if you find some of that success, your products are just going to get ripped off. And a local is going to make something very similar and undercut your price, and then you're sort of going to tank. You're going to go out of business. I would not be putting a ton of effort into the Chinese market in the way that these companies seem to think they're going to find some kind of major success. So definitely check out this article from Notebook Check. I mean, again, I go to Notebook Check to read up on like laptop processor specs, but apparently they've been doing some pretty decent EV coverage too. But yeah, this move, it apparently was sort of a major contributing factor to the CEO of Hertz Rent-A-Car stepping down as CEO of Hertz Rent-A-Car over the purchasing of 100,000 Teslas now burning him bad. And especially with all the news recently of the Cybertruck kind of getting delivered to customers falling apart. I saw a really cute video of someone who was like, oh yeah, I mean, the Cybertruck arrived and there was like a little rust on there. But don't worry, it's not like bad rust, it's just a little surface rust and I could just scrape it right off. Sort of ignoring that the oxidization of metal, all rust is surface rust, but I digress. I can't think of very many other companies that have fallen as fast in sort of the public's estimation of being a cool company and then now becoming kind of a joke or the punchline to a joke. And I'm still waiting for that final like market correction to occur. What is it going to take? And someone drop me a comment here in the chat. What is it going to take for a proper market correction on how poorly Elon Musk has been operating as the figurehead of companies like SpaceX, Tesla, and Twitter? What will eventually get all of those people that are, you know, sort of blind sycophants that always try to make it sound like, oh, but I mean, it's like no big deal if your Tesla's tonneau cover doesn't work. I mean, they'll fix it. So you just go ahead and take the vehicle, even though it's broken, and then, you know, Tesla, well, they'll totally maintenance it. You don't have to worry about that. I think at some point, the bottom has to fall out. I just don't know, how do you get there? It seems to be, to me, that as long as you're still one of the wealthiest people on the planet, you just have an army of people that desperately want to promote how awesome you are just for being rich. And so I don't think that's ever going to go away, but I think the whole sheen of, you know, Elon Musk is an eccentric genius who's going to do some Tony Stark stuff and bring us the future, that's pretty much gone. I still occasionally bump into somebody who's like, yeah, Elon Musk, he's pretty bright. He's a weird dude, but yeah, he's done some pretty cool things. And now it's like even that's starting to erode. Where it's like, no, Elon Musk seems to just always be the guy who buys his way into something that is kind of cool and makes himself the face of it. And then he's gotten lucky with government contracts that subsidize the business he's trying to make, but it's through no actual business acumen. He's just really good at trying to convince politicians to give him money, taxpayer money, so that his businesses can stay afloat. All right, let's see. Dave Burns, it's super cool for it to become a three-wheeled vehicle on the interstate. That would be kind of fun. Just I bought this Tesla, but now it's a trike. Simon says, Hypno, Dave Burns, car-free American equals pinko commie socialist Marxist. Dave Burns says, I love seeing the Ioniq 6 in my neighborhood. They look so cool. I'm still leaning towards Ioniq 5. Something it's a, I would prefer, like with that new Rivian 3, I want to say it is, the little one. I want a little EV hot hatch. But having a daughter and doing activities and occasionally wanting to like maybe road trip and do some other stuff, like we'll probably end up on something like an Ioniq 5. But it just makes me sad because like Tesla was going to be our go-to when they said that they were going to make a little Tesla hatchback, like a Tesla 2. I was pretty stoked. Like something just, you know, I love a little hot hatchback. I want a zippy little car. I currently am tooling around in an old, beat-up, busted Nissan Versa. Is it an exciting car to drive? Not at all. Does it get incredible gas mileage, even though it's a totally a gas car and it's not an EV or a hybrid? I can kind of run it to like 40 miles on a gallon, especially if I'm doing a good mix of like freeway, not stop-and-go driving. And it's old enough that like I can fix most of it with like a socket set. Like if I need to do a brake job, I can still do a brake job on my ancient Nissan Versa. So anyway, I'll just be curious. I'll be really curious to see when does this last like remaining shred of Elon Musk adulation finally fall apart? This is another one. I'll be really curious to see some of your thoughts. Apple just had their recent MacBook event talking about how, you know, this is the most AI laptop that's ever been made in the history of laptops and AI. But if you notice, like, Apple didn't really do anything. I think this is one of the things that I'm really tired of in the current flavor of Apple, is they're not contributing anything to this new product segment or this new market. Their mixed reality headset, the Vision Pro, is an incredible collection of micro OLEDs, apparently poorly focused. So if you get the lens on the Vision Pro, it's actually blurring more detail than if you had a lower resolution screen like on something like the Quest. I'd need some other people to kind of confirm the clarity and the measurements of how you measure the optics in the Vision Pro, but for all of those dots on those micro OLEDs, you're really not getting better clarity than what you can achieve with other lower resolution screens. I've sidetracked myself. We're trying to move to this next story, not relitigate some of these past things. But the MacBook event came out, and they were like, yes, our laptops are AI now. All they did, as far as I can tell, all they did was open up the neural core compute features for devs to make more apps that can utilize that on-device machine learning. I'm not seeing anything else. Like, Apple hasn't done anything with AI. Siri hasn't gotten any smarter. There is no generative Apple system. And now we're getting news that to kind of help improve the machine learning and language model use of Apple products, that Apple is likely going to partner with Google and license Gemini to be the backbone of iPhone AI features. So Apple isn't even making their own AI. They're just making a phone chip that has a neural core setup on it, a machine learning set of NPUs or whatever we want to call them. And the actual backbone of this service will go through Google software to utilize their set of parameters and generative models. I am not excited about this. Like, at some point, you've got to say, like, if the future of this kind of mobile interaction, mobile compute, if your phone becoming a better assistant matters to you, well, then what is the experience that Apple is really bringing to the table? And from what I've read and from the interviews that I've had with, like, MediaTek and Qualcomm executives, it's like Apple is also really kind of going lean on a lot of the technologies that would empower a better AI experience. Like, you need RAM. You need a lot of RAM to unpack billions of parameters in a language learning model. And we know Apple goes really lean on MacBook RAM and iPhone RAM and iPad RAM because they know their consumers aren't really invested in the specs and the performance and all the things that you can do with these different devices. You buy the iPhone so that you have the right color text message bubbles, right? That's like a major sort of social pressure that goes into owning an Apple product, not, oh, I got this thing because it has these incredible capabilities. So I totally believe that an ARM chip with a decently powerful NPU should easily be able to embarrass any Intel-powered laptop out there. Intel and AMD are way behind on these little NPU chiplets that you can stitch into a phone or a tablet or a MacBook. So I totally believe Apple when they say, hey, we can do this many floating point operations and we can do all of these kinds of tensor operations and NPU operations and we can crush this much data. Absolutely, totally believe it. I totally believe that the M3 NPU is more powerful than anything AMD has put into a laptop. But what can you do with it? How do you make your laptop the bestest for AI if you haven't brought any services or platforms or products to the table? If you're only just hoping that developers are going to take that NPU and run with it and build the services for you, then you haven't done anything with AI. And that's what's so concerning. So if you care about this kind of gen or edge AI, whatever we're going to call it, I still try to talk about it in terms of machine learning and sort of language learning models, because it's not really any kind of emergent intelligence. Your experiences on an iPhone are going to be exceedingly similar to using Gemini on an Android. If you talk to Siri as your assistant, you're likely just getting search results from Google. I just don't understand, again, at what point do you look at what you're paying to own some of the most expensive tech products on the planet? And if you say you care about this direction of technology or these features or this kind of capability, it's not really a good platform for that. It's not really the platform that's going to drive any of the change or innovation or improvement to this kind of setup. On top of that, I'll just be really curious to see, will Apple go the Google route of making this as cloud-based as possible? Again, I'm very anxious to see over the next year or two the difference between on-device capabilities and cloud capabilities. That's one of the talking points in my OnePlus 12 versus Pixel 8 Pro video, is both of these companies talking up, hey, our phones do AI stuff and photo editing and processing and look at all this cool stuff. But one company is really leaning into doing as much as they can on device. And the other company is heading off in the opposite direction of everything you do has to get uploaded to a server and processed in the cloud and then shot back down to your phone. And that's a lot of data, especially if you start working with like video clips. That's a lot of information that you've got to transfer back and forth. Let me take another drink of water here. Let me see if we got any fun comments. Let's see. Dave Burns is saying, I still don't use AI on the daily, not in like a proud way. I just don't have access to a tool that it's useful for yet. I've been dabbling with some stuff, but so far the only thing that I've done with AI was I was able to get it to sort of cobble together a thumbnail image for my OmniVision camera video, where I've got a wrestler that's leaping from the top rope. Let me tell you, that took a lot of tries. I used Microsoft Copilot and said, hey, can you draw a picture of two wrestlers on the mat and a third wrestler jumping off the top rope about to land on them? And I think it took me, I didn't really fully count, but I know it was over a dozen alterations to the prompt before I got something that was kind of usable. And then it took yet another 10, hey, refine this image, eliminate extra limbs. It was a nightmarish Play-Doh gobble of like the wrestler that's jumping off the top rope had like three arms and one leg and like this distorted head. All right, give me another image like that, but can we have the wrestlers have the correct number of limbs? And then the two wrestlers on the mat would get like knotted together. They were technically two wrestlers, but they would be like this blob where you couldn't tell where one wrestler ended and the other began. Al Sabakli, everything is AI now. Laptops, phones, tractors, spoons, tacos. I would be very curious on the benefits of an AI taco. That is the food of my people, and I wonder how we could make that more intelligent. Simon says HypnoPixels will now get AI features after Samsung and Apple devices now. Someone shared on Threads like a shocked reaction emoji of Samsung after the news that Apple put out on AI with Google. And you're like, yeah, Samsung has been so thirsty to try and be the Apple of Android land. And now, if you want Google AI features, you could get them on a Galaxy, or I guess you could get them on an iPhone now. I guess, you know, if you're going to copy the iPhone, you should lose sales to the iPhone, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry, Nicholas, you're giving me some great stuff on Elon Musk and EVs, and these are excellent comments, and I don't mean to just be kind of skipping them. It's just, we've got a lot of show to get through, so unfortunately, I'm just going to ask that people catch your comments and read them, but I'm not going to go back and check them out. But thank you, Nicholas. These are really solid points that you're bringing up. Simon says, if no, I use ChatGPT to create really good journey prompts. It sounds about right. Just like AI for AI to make AI content that AI will like. And Michael Corcoran, I do a lot of research on health stuff, and it's absolutely dreadful for information about healthcare. It doesn't rely on peer review, very little help. It can be a little convenient if you want it to make a quick chart for health spending by GDP, but even then, it will often have dated data that you have to correct for anyway. So, my experiences have been pretty poor. I'm trying to find, like, if there's a good tool. So, for example, someone recently, and I would love some suggestions here. Someone recently suggested it would be a benefit if, on my podcast, I did better chapter marking. But I ramble so much, it's really, really difficult to kind of line up the time code. It's almost like I've just got to listen to my podcast in real time and go, oh, okay, right about here I was talking about this news article, and right about here I was talking about this phone. How do I put all that together? And there have been a couple like AI tools, like how to add chapter markings to your audio podcasts. I don't understand where the metadata lives on an MP3 so that you can add chapter tags. It's not in the ID3 tags. So I'm looking up all these tools. There's like an online tool. Most of this is written for Mac. There is almost no PC software that can add ID3 tags and chapter markings to an MP3 file. If you upload to a service that does it for you and tries to automate, there's one, it's like, oh, we'll use AI to listen to your podcast and then add the appropriate chapter markers. And you're like, cool. And then there's like, it's only going to be like $100 a month, and you have a maximum of hour per podcast. And you're like, I regularly have 3-hour podcasts. I cannot use your service. So it's incredible. Yeah, Pup on Tech, that's great. Everyone would like chapter markings. What I need is someone who wants chapter markings on this podcast to reach out and say, here's how I think you could do it. Because I have been digging for the last month on what is the solution to try and deliver that. And I haven't found anything that's genuinely capable of kind of automating some of that workflow. And even if I did it manually, I can't find a good consistent way to add the metadata to an MP3 file on my own. Like if I just had, you know, an MP3 ID3 tag editor, I could go in there and just put in chapter, this time code, chapter, this time code, chapter, this time code. I would do it manually if I could, but I can't even do that. It does not live in a easily publicly addressable way for me to edit that information in the MP3 file. So, oh, Pup on Tech is saying they'll look into it for me. Okay. Let me know. I'm serious. Like I need the assist, and I think it is something that would kind of help for a podcast that regularly runs over 2 hours long. We got a couple just quick little techie stories here. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this because I don't feel this is the big exciting thing that Qualcomm is going to want to talk about over the next couple weeks. but it's interesting in a where does it fit kind of way. So, let me get this out of the way here. So, sorry, going to screen share. This is coming by way... Actually, these next two stories are both coming from GSM Arena. This one was written up by Peter. Hello, Peter at GSM Arena. Snapdragon 8S Gen 3 arrives with Cortex X4 Core to power the flagship killers of 2024. The 8S Gen 3 is a... I was kind of confused by just the naming on it, but the 8S Gen 3 is similar to the 8 Gen 3 in some ways, but it has a different medium core configuration, and it has a lower power GPU than the 8 Gen 2. So, for example, the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 has an Adreno 740, the 8S Gen 3 has an Adreno 735, and one of the differences, especially when we look at like camera performance, the 8 Gen 2 is capable of 8K video at up to 30 frames per second and 4K video at up to 120 frames per second. The 8S Gen 3 is only capable of 4K video up to 60 frames per second and 1080p at up to 240 frames per second. So this is a significantly detuned chip from the 8 Gen 3 and the 8 Gen 2. I'm very anxious about Qualcomm's naming convention. We have a Snapdragon 8 Gen 3. The 8 Gen 3 is an incredible powerhouse chip. We also have an 8 Gen 2, which is still one of the all-time best performance per watt players we've ever seen in mobile. It is phenomenal. It will be a phenomenal chip for years to come. It is the spiritual successor to the venerable Snapdragon 865. By naming another chip an 8S Gen 3 and giving it a beefier CPU capabilities over the 8 Gen 2, but weaker GPU capabilities over the 8 Gen 2, it's in a weird middle spot. I almost feel like this should be the premier Snapdragon 7 series. Depending on what you care about for why you buy your phone, the performance of this might be better for CPU-bound tasks, so maybe something like video editing might get a little bit of a nudge over an 8 Gen 2. But then, if you care about gaming, I think you're probably in for a better experience if you look for an 8 Gen 2 powered phone that's maybe a year older, or you can find a great deal on something like OnePlus 12R. OnePlus 12R just has a proper Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, and it's a very inexpensive phone. That thing's a monster. So where does an 8S Gen 3 fit into this crazy lineup of different chips and parts and pieces? And I kind of feel like that should be like a Snapdragon 7 Plus Gen 4, whatever. But it is using that Cortex X4, it is using that one same big core, so I kind of get why it's an 8 series, but it's now splitting the difference between an 8 Gen 3 and an 8 Gen 2, and it doesn't carry the same graphics performance of the 8 Gen 2. I feel like Qualcomm really needs to take a look at their product lineup and their product roadmap and just try to find ways to sort of simplify what's happening with some of these different pieces.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Juan, thank you for the honor of having me on your podcast to kind of let everybody know that I do what's called Engineer Reacts. I react to smartphones, and you can find these reactions at www.youtube.com/C/Barry Johnson. I do about 1 to 2 video reactions per week, all on smartphone tech. Also, in addition to this, I'm actually going to start posting on Easy Computer Solutions channel as well, as he just has so much product that he tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, I need a little bit of help over there as well. So again, Juan, I appreciate it and hope you have a great rest of the podcast.
So one of the things that was confusing to me, and also why I don't love their naming convention, at first I thought the 8S Gen 3 was just going to be like a detuned or a clock speed throttled 8 Gen 3. So we have this thing called binning. So you make a whole bunch of chips, and not all of the chips perform the same. And so sometimes in process, I'm grossly oversimplifying this, sometimes in processor land, you take like the best performing chip and you say, okay, well, this is going to be the top tier product. And then you take some of these chips where like, hey, two of these cores don't really work the way that they should. So we'll call that a medium tier model. And then we've got a couple of these chips where it's like, okay, there is a certain performance within a certain envelope that is totally appropriate for these tasks. And we'll put this into a different bucket. We literally bin the chips based on how well they can perform. So what I thought the 8S Gen 3 was going to be is a different binning. Instead of getting an 8 Gen Plus 3 or 8 Plus Gen 3 or 8 Gen 3 Plus, the 8 Gen 3 is a monster. There's really no reason to give us an even higher performance part on the 8 Gen 3. So if we have some chips that are kind of underperforming, why don't we slap an S label? But the medium cores are different. So Qualcomm has gone out of their way to include a big Cortex X4 CPU core. They purpose-built the 8S to fit into this spot. It's not just some of these chips are underperforming, so we can't sell them to premium phone manufacturers. There are different medium cores between the 8S and the 8. And they purposely put a different Adreno GPU on this. Oh, and it also has a different modem. So instead of having the X75 modem, it has the X70 modem. So they made this chip to be this way. And that's what I don't get. This to me is a very interesting product launch. And I'm curious. I wonder who in the chat, I wonder who do you think is going to use this chip as for like a mid-ranger kind of phone? Right? I still think this is going to be kind of an expensive product. It's still a 4-nanometer part. It's still a Cortex X4, you know, UFS4, USB 3.1 Gen 2. I mean, like, every part of this is still kind of a pricey chip. So, does this end up in a Poco? Pocos have now been kind of pushing more into the 7 series chips just to kind of keep costs in line. I don't know where this fits, and I wonder, like, how much can you really sell this below the price of the 8 Gen 3 and not be stepping on, you know, running out your inventory on the 8 Gen 2 and using all the 7 series phones. Aditya Anil saying nothing phone. So wasn't the nothing, didn't the more expensive nothing phone use the Snapdragon 8 Plus Gen 1? I want to say that that's what they used. Someone please correct me if I have that wrong. Yeah, Pup on Tech. I think they're doing it on purpose. Yeah, this is purpose built. So it's not even like we binned this chip and it wasn't as good. It's like, wow, you really made this thing to be exactly this position. Simon says Hypno, it's an 8 Gen 3, just like all Galaxies are the same. I heard someone say the Galaxy S24 Ultra was the best, so I went to my carrier store and had a good sale on the Galaxy S24. That's a totally different phone. No, it's Galaxy S. Yeah, Pop on Tech, this is why I'm kind of confused. It makes no sense, as this is a flagship killer type chip, but not as good for gaming. Usually gamers, flagship killers, people want raw GPU power. And that's not what they're going to get here. Now, it'll be better than any phone that's probably rocking a 7 series, I think, but it's just such a weird position to be in. And again, to recommend, if you can grab a phone with an 8 Gen 2 on sale, that's probably going to be better overall than what you're going to get with this new chip. And J-Man and Pop on Tech and Barry Johnson, Nothing Phone 2 was the 8 Plus Gen 1. Okay, so I had that right. My brain leaks like a sieve, so I didn't know if that was the deal. So anyway, I don't know. Drop the name of the company. So far, the only suggestion we've had is nothing. drop the name of a company in the chat who you think will be the first to use an 8S Gen 3. My vote is going Poco. I think Poco will be the first to use an 8S Gen 3. So we'll have to see how that lands. Dave Burns is saying maybe a photography-focused phone? I don't know. I don't think, again, if you say it's a really hardcore photography-focused phone, you lose out on a lot of video capability. I know, like, you know, I don't really promote or do a lot shooting 8K, but if you're telling me that this is, like, the purpose of the phone is camera and photos and videos, that is kind of a spec that you want to have on there. Okay, so we've got some predictions here. We'll have to revisit this at some point. I'm going to try and make a note of what episode I did this in. Muppinish is saying Xiaomi. Dave Burns is saying OnePlus/Vivo. Right? Two picks right there. Michael Corcoran also saying Xiaomi. Simon says Hypno says Realme. All right, Realme versus Poco. Simon, I accept your challenge. Gauntlet has been thrown. Pup on Tech is saying it will be in a OnePlus Nord, nothing, and Poco. Malik is saying Poco, Redmi, or OnePlus if they do a T series. Ah, actually, that's kind of clever too. So, like a Xiaomi T series. But that's what's kind of tricky is the 8S Gen 3 has to undercut the price of a Dimensity 9300. Because the Xiaomi T series last year was using the 9200 Plus. That was a great chip to get at a lower cost than an 8 Gen 2. And Pup on Tech is saying maybe a mid-ranger Sony. Well, that carries us into our next article here, because I don't know what's going on with Sony in the premium tier or in the mid-range. There have been lots of rumors floating about Sony recently, and I'd love to see some thoughts on what people think. So this is the other story written up by Vlad at GSM Arena. The Sony Xperia 1 Mark 6 might give up on the 4K display and the tall aspect ratio. And then they have a sort of a concept render of what that'd look like, where they're going to step down to a more traditional 19.5:9 aspect ratio instead of a 21:9 aspect ratio. And you can see just that it gets a little bit wider. That's kind of the big difference is, instead of a 4K resolution, it'll probably be one of these 1440p plus resolutions that, again, we're very familiar with these on other phones. I've been saying for a while that as soon as you hit to 20:9, the difference between a phone at 20:9 and 21:9 is not extreme. And it took me a second glance to look at these concept renders and go, oh, okay, I see what they're doing. It is a little bit wider. But how many people? So I've got two. First of all, just what are your thoughts on Sony making their phone a little bit wider? I'm kind of disappointed if they lose out on what is going to become a Sony Xperia design. And two, how many articles do you think we're going to get from tech outlets saying, Sony's watering down their iconic design, but those are the same reviewers who always complained about, oh, who could even use an Xperia? It's so tall and it's so skinny and it hurts my wrist when I have to use it because it's so tall and I just can't handle. And then that exact same reviewer is going to come out and go, why even buy an Xperia if it's more like other phones now? If it's just going to be the same as other phones, you should just buy those other phones. And I'm already hating the imaginary editorials and write-ups that I'm already seeing. But if it comes to pass, and an Xperia 1 Mark 6 does arrive with this kind of screen display, with this kind of display aspect ratio and resolution, there is going to be an army of influencer reviewers that will just need to line up and stooge slap. Just hand out, run down the line, tack, 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 tack. I'm upset because I don't feel like Sony ever really landed the messaging on having the 4K resolution. There's something incredible about putting out a phone with a 4K display, because if you really pay attention to the measurement of the visual acuity of the human eye, It's around a 4K resolution on a phone-sized display that we completely max out the human eye's ability to discern dots and pixels in detail. At the minimum focusing distance, at 20/20 vision, your visual acuity is starting to approach a screen that would be populated with a 4K number of dots. Not to mention people who have better than 20/20 vision. And I feel like there could have been something in there. In the way that, like, LG did kind of land a certain quality of understanding from tech nerds on quad DAC, on much, much higher audio fidelity, much, much higher audio resolution, that did help cement, like, oh, if you want a phone that does the good audio, LG should be your pick. And there were techies who didn't understand anything about, like, the actual mechanics of it, but at least that little germ of an idea of marketing got through. And I feel like Sony kind of missed the boat. At a 4K panel, we have nowhere else to go. We're done. That's it. That's what you need to accomplish to make sure anyone who has optical enhancement, maybe like really aggressive magnification on their glasses, anyone who has better than 20/20 vision, or people with 20/20 vision but who are more inclined to hold their phone a little closer to their face, at a 4K resolution, we are done. There is no improvement from there. You have maximized the visual acuity of the human eye in this panel. So I'll personally be sad if Sony walks away from this, because even before the current Xperia line, the previous, like, Sony Z series, they had 4K displays. There was a reason why Sony was on this bandwagon, but I don't think they ever put the messaging behind it that they really could have. And of course, there were those other issues too, where a lot of the apps and services on your phone would be run in 1/4 resolution, kind of a 1080p adjacent resolution. It wasn't true 4K. So I totally appreciate why some people were very critical of Sony's marketing and presentation of that. I don't believe there were many apps or services that ever properly ran at 4K 120. It would either be 4K or it would be 1080p binned down resolution at 120 hertz, but I was still kind of in there watching content on a Sony display, especially when you have really good 4K Blu-ray rips. It looks really good. Now those Blu-rays are only playing at 2997, so you don't have to have 120 hertz, but still, it was a unique feature perk. I'll also be really sad because Sony's are very easily one-handable. So that narrower display, I liked it. I really dug it. That was something that appealed to me. And having like a lot of vertical space for apps that you scroll through, having a good cinema wide for the kinds of movies that I like to watch, and then just not being quite as broad to reach my thumb over. We got Marie the Pixel 8 to replace her old phone that kind of got all busted up. And in between, she was using my Xperia 1 Mark IV to see if she would like the Sony. We were maybe going to get her an Xperia 5, Xperia 5 Mark V. And then that never came to the United States. And so instead, we got her the Pixel 8. But she still has my Xperia 1 Mark IV and has kind of refused to give it back. So I'll have to work on her for that. But I think in light of the Xperia 5 not coming to the United States and the Xperia 1 Mark VI taking sort of a more distinct turn from the traditional Xperia design, my hope would be that Sony is using this extra width to maybe bump up the battery capacity a little bit, maybe improve some of the internal cooling, so you have just a little bit more area, a little bit more surface area, a little bit more depth. I think that all would be fine. If they start down that path of, well, we're also going to get rid of the headphone jack, or why do you need to expand the storage, or getting rid of some of the advanced features or capabilities of what makes a Sony, I'll be more upset. If this screen is a little less expensive to incorporate into the Sony phone, and this helps keep prices in check while other technologies improve, I'm not going to be too upset about that. But it is a bit of a bummer. Sony was like this last holdout. We're making our phone different. We're making our phone the way we think we should make a phone, not just copycatting every other manufacturer out there. And little steps like this make me anxious. Like, I really do feel Sony is probably looking at an exit strategy from North America. Why keep sending your phones to North America if you're going to sell tens of units, right? They're not in carrier stores. They don't want to approach that kind of a relationship with United States carriers. So I do have to wonder how much time we really have left with the Xperia line, even though from just like a units sold perspective, they're still profitable. Like, Sony's still making money on these phones. They're not selling at a loss and having to buffer the Xperia division with other products making more money. But it doesn't seem like they're really trying to aggressively push what is a Sony-first solution for a 21st century pocket computer. And instead, these moves all feel like compromises. All these moves feel like a Sony that's like, oh, okay, well, I guess we could do this too. And that's the worst place to be. It's what's killing Samsung right now. It makes all of these products less exciting. The Sony design has always been a bit divisive, but that keeps you in a conversation where your product is different. And that's a good thing for these reasons. But they're not following up with the good marketing to tell consumers why their products are the way they are. So then if you see a Sony and it's kind of like any other phone, but the forehead and chin bezels are bigger, why would you buy it? Why jump on that? It doesn't make any sense to me. So anyway, let me catch back because we did have some comments here. And I'm going to drink another little drink of water. And then we're going to talk about more photography. Huzzah! So Simon says, Sepino saying the 4K screen is lovely, but overkill. Aditya Anil, Sony is in their F around and find out phase. I don't know. I mean, like, I'm still really positive on what the Xperia represents. That's why I don't want to lose it. I don't want to lose it as a competitive option against Samsung trying to make another iPhone. Aditya Anil, I genuinely think the extra width would be noticeable. The tall Sony is surprisingly comfortable to hold. I completely agree. Carl Gunderson, though, immediately snaps back. About time Sony is going back to a more traditional aspect ratio instead of doing the cinema-style aspect ratio. And Carl, I have to ask, like, what does a more traditional aspect ratio mean? Because 19.5 by 9 is not any kind of traditional aspect ratio. It's so much closer to 21 by 9 than it is 16 by 9. So it's kind of just this middle step in between. It's not even a middle step. It's still almost 21 by 9. It's just not 21 by 9. So that's the thing I've never kind of gotten about the argument against Sony's aspect ratio. Is because Samsung's are 19.5 by 9. I want to say Vivo's, like this Vivo, I think is 20 by 9. I might have that a little bit off. But we're already so close. So if there is cinema that is shot at a 21 by 9 aspect ratio, then it is perfectly represented on a 21 by 9 display. It's not just a little off down to 20 or 19.5 by 9. Anyway, I'm not picking on you. I'm just kind of curious. Like, people say stuff like that and you're like, yeah, but we're not close. We're not close to a traditional aspect ratio. Simon says, Hypno, my bad, eyesight prefers a wider screen. Pup on Tech saying, seems like Sony is dead if they just make it like everyone else. Michael Corcoran, I understand Sony's motives, but I'm in favor of anything that keeps some variety in the market, but that feels like it's getting harder to do, at least at scale. And I'd be curious to see, like, maybe if the Xperia 1 Mark V didn't sell very well. I haven't seen good reporting on what their last year of sales look like, especially because their launch for the Xperia 5 was very haphazard. It was very limited and very regionally dependent. Muppinish, the 4K screen on my Pro I is definitely overkill, but I do like the tall design, but I wouldn't disregard Sony based on its design only. Pup on Tech, definitely agree on the tech reviewers. You're going to have so many people like, oh, why even buy one now? Wait a minute, isn't that what you were complaining about? Is that you wanted a Sony that was more like other phones? But no, it's not different. God, I hate tech reviewers so much. Maybe Malik? I don't know that this is Sony's grand plan, though. This is interesting. All right, Malik is saying it would make sense if they want to undercut Samsung to be a display distributor. I don't know if that's what Sony is looking to do, because I think Sony is much more interested in selling the best parts of their own tech in their own labeled device. But you know what? If the Xperia is under the Alpha camera division, then yeah, maybe that could be part of the play or part of the pitch. The reason why I kind of feel like the Xperia might be looking, Sony might be looking at an exit strategy for the Xperia is their mid-ranger lineup sounds like it's going to be going through a couple changes. The Xperia 5, like I said, got that really wishy-washy release. And then it doesn't look like they're looking to put out another Pro, like a Pro or a Pro I. What they did instead is they made a 5G-enabled camera monitor that looks a lot like an Xperia, but it's super, super thick, has a fan, and has full-sized ports that you can plug into, a full-size HDMI and a full-size Ethernet port. And that, I think, is taking the place of an Xperia Pro. A lot of the same parts and pieces as an Xperia Pro, but just the extra depth to make it more of a focused broadcast camera accessory. So I think Sony has kind of learned what they need to learn from Xperia phones. And if they continue to make and sell Xperia phones, it's going to continue to sort of refine and whittle down into only a couple options left. And Michael, I'm with you there. I so hate to see any distinctive feature go away. The diminutive Zen Phone 10, 4K displays, etc., etc. Simon says, if no, it's not double standards. Just excuses to make articles like Sony aspect ratio. I was wrong. Now that Sony has left the smartphone market, I'm sad. I told you never to buy one and that you should only buy Sam Apples. But now we miss the competition from Sony. Who would ever, how do you even say Xperia XIII? Oh, who could even buy one of these? But now that they're gone, aw, we should miss them. Muppinish, they should make a rollable phone. Introducing the Sony Xperia Cinema. Extend your experience. I'm still waiting to see any company make a scrolling motorized phone in any way practical. I really think that's like the worst daily lifestyle design I've seen yet. It was kind of interesting to see like the concepts, you know, when Oppo and LG were showing off rolling extendable phones, but you've got a motor that extends a plastic display out to the sides. That means like the edges of that display have to like curl and contract, and the motor has to be powerful enough that it can open up so that you can use it when you want to, as opposed to just a regular foldable that opens. Like, now I'm done. Now my OnePlus Open is open and I can use it. As opposed to, well, here, I've got my phone. Let me push the expand button. Zzzz. Now I can use my phone. I just feel like in all of the whiz-bangery, in all of the sci-fi coolness, it's the least practical, most fragile. It's the worst design for making these things better. So I'll be really curious if anyone even really tries to bring one to market in a serious way. Carl Gunderson, Juan, are you expecting the next Xperia to come to the States given their track record? And I genuinely don't know. I've actually kind of lost touch with Sony PR over the last year. I was doing a lot of work on Xperia 1, and I tried to make a bigger play saying, hey, I've got an international audience. I'd love to cover more Xperia 5. And their PR kind of acted like, oh, well, if you get a lot of traffic in regions like India, where our phones are really popular for people to watch videos about Xperia, then I don't think we should work together anymore. And I was really kind of taken back by that. Like, people are curious about your phones all over the world. And I'm based in the United States, but that doesn't mean, like, we can't have a conversation just talking about, like, where these things might go or what might be. So we were planning all of these follow-ups. Like, I was even going to interview some of the Sony engineers about like the differences in camera camera sensor technologies. But that kind of fell apart, and now they haven't gotten back to me. I'm very anxious that this is a slow decrescendo, a chilling of Sony selling in regions where they're not immediately popular. And I don't think it's going to happen with Xperia 1 Mark 6. I think Xperia 1 Mark 6 might still come to the United States. I'm not confident that into the next 3 years, Sony is really going to be looking at a regional distribution strategy that involves North America. I don't think the Xperia is long for our markets here in the United States. Yeah, Pup on Tech, we kind of talked about this a little on Best of Our Week where I got real cranky. Pup on Tech says, Zenfone is also dead. The new one is just an ROG button, ROG phone without the shoulder triggers. And I don't get Zenfone Ultra at all. I think it's ugly. I think it's kind of expensive. I don't think Asus has great software support. This is a very difficult phone to recommend in light of all of the incredible options that you can kind of get around that price with better everything than what's on that Asus. Better cameras, faster charging, better battery life, better displays. I don't get it. I used to do so much work with Asus PC building, and now, I mean, I've never had a relationship with Asus Zenfone, and I don't get it. I really don't get it. Let's see. So Goat V8, this is, I totally appreciate this, but it's kind of why I wanted Sony to be in there. Goat V8 says 4K kind of seems like the high refresh rate phones. It's nice to look at, but not necessary. And I want to ask, like, what do we expect on a phone that's going to sell between like $1,200 and $1,400? I want the best of everything that company has to offer. I look at a $1,300 iPhone Pro. I'm not impressed by the collection of technologies that are in an iPhone Pro at $1,300. Right now, I'm writing up my Galaxy S24 Ultra camera review. I'm not impressed with the quartet of cameras that you buy at $1,300 on the back of an S24 Ultra. I don't think they're getting it done. So when I see a Sony Xperia, well, it was the last one, the Xperia 1 Mark 5 had a little bit of a price cut, but I want to say it was still like a $1,300 phone. You had variable telephoto zooming optics. You had the newest Sony camera sensor in that main camera. You had a screen that was unlike any other screen on the market today. You had a headphone jack, you had memory card expansion with 256 gig of storage, you had decent stereo speakers. Like, you had everything on that phone. So I appreciated that it should have been an expensive phone. But no one should feel like a $1,300 or $1,400 phone is necessary and then only expect it to cover the lowest common denominator basic use that tech reviewers apply to average consumers. That's a $400 phone. A $400 phone might be necessary. A $1,400 phone should not be just slightly better than a $400 phone. So anyway, I'm not picking on you, Goat V8, but I was like, that's the way that we frame this conversation. Oh, I mean, it's nice to have, but it's not necessary. Then why make expensive phones if they're not going to do things that are different than less expensive phones? What is it that the expensive phone does? Show me how that's different, and I'll be very anxious to see, like, oh, well, that's something I would be kind of, it's outlandish. It's a conversation starter. Oh, this Sony, oh, you've got an iPhone. My Sony is like $1,000 more than your iPhone. Why? Well, because it does this, 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 and this, and it's a Japanese phone, and look at all these other crazy things, and I can have a conversation about it. So, I want us to rephrase in our brain what is the outcome. And it can't just be the Apple logo on the box means that I should have to spend more, and it doesn't do anything else different than another phone that costs less. Dave Burns, one, those tech reviewers would be so mad at you if they could read. Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, Barry, and I feel like a lot of people were kind of in that vibe too. I'm sad Sony was the only phone that I felt could really keep Samsung on their toes. It's a sad day. Now, obviously, these are rumors and mock-ups and concepts. We don't know that this is how it's going to play out, but it's coming from some sources where I'm starting to feel like this could be kind of legit, or at least a trend in that direction. So we'll have to see. Now, unfortunately, I kind of feel like Oppo, Vivo, and Xiaomi are the main companies that are keeping Samsung on their toes, but that doesn't mean Samsung has any pressure here in the United States. And that's a major issue. So we're in really dangerous territory here with Samsung and Apple taking up 80% of the smartphone market. And Carl, yeah, I'm kind of with you, but I liked that. Okay, so hold on, sorry. Let me read Carl's post. I'm honestly surprised that Sony hasn't dipped out of the US market yet, since they dipped out of the Canadian market along with Huawei and Honor right before the pandemic started. So one of the reasons why I feel Sony kept the toehold that they did is it was around that time that the Xperia division was really put under the Sony Alpha, the camera division. And now looking back on it, the Xperia Pro I and the Xperia Pro, those phones to me look like test markets, test products to see, is there a Sony broadcast future? And actually that stuff worked pretty well. The first Xperia Pro was really more of a broadcast modem brain for professional grade cameras. And that sold surprisingly well to television stations, to schools. It was a really big thing, especially in colleges. So you could very quickly come up with sort of a live stream solution on any camera that you could plug into the Xperia Pro. And I think Sony learned a lot from how to make broadcast and smart brain display monitor accessories for the Alpha. And now we see in Japan, there is a dedicated smart display that looks a lot like an Xperia, but it's not a phone. And that's where I feel like the Alpha camera division is likely wanting to go more aggressively. Can we make better tools and accessories to keep people in the Sony Alpha ecosystem? And that's the direction that they're going to walk. I feel like the phone division is going to kind of slow play its way out, just based on profitability and sales and numbers and all of those other metrics. It won't vanish, but it's probably going to kind of, you know, limit what regions those phones are sold in. And I think it might end up like Sharp. Like, there's going to be an Xperia, but it's only available in Japan and China. I think that's a very likely outcome for the Sony Xperia division over the next 5 years. I accidentally bumped my keyboard and I was worried I'd just shut the whole stream down. DTNL, no average consumer is spending $1,300 on a phone. If you think so, kindly go outside and touch grass. And Diago is saying, like, the expensive phone is a status symbol. I don't think anyone cares about expensive phone status. I think there is a type of consumer who cares about bullying people with different colored text message bubbles here in the United States. And that person is only interested in whether or not you have an Apple. If you have an Apple, cool, I guess you can be friends. But if you don't have an Apple, ugh, it's always the worst talking to people without Apples. And that's it. I think the rest of the world, no one cares what phone you have. No one is flashing their phone and going, oh, that person is wealthy and successful, and I would like to engage in marital relations with that individual. Going back to our Pornhub conversation, right? That does not exist at all. The phone is a commodity. It is a utilitarian communication appliance that is mandatory in the 21st century age, and no one cares if you spent a lot on your phone. Occasionally, you find some novelty. People love playing with my OnePlus Open and my Pixel Fold. They think they're neat, but they don't care that those are crazy expensive products. They're not going to buy them. They're not interested in flashing them or flexing or anything like that. It is even Gen Z and younger, Gen Alpha, they moved on to Stanley Cups as the fashion flex. Do you have the right kind of insulated coffee mug? was more important than, do you have the right kind of phone? Nobody cares about your phone. There is no status to derive. So if there's no status, what I want to see is $1,400 worth of phone that can kick butt against laptops and cameras, MP3 players, and all of the other gadgets and accessories I might want to buy. Maybe I can just spend more on my phone and take care of all that other stuff. And that's what I want. But capability is never going to be as sexy as fashion. The fashion, the marketing, the presentation, sure, I guess. But no one cares. No one thinks an expensive phone means you're a more successful individual now. Go V8. And again, I know we've had a previous conversation, so I wasn't picking on you. Goat V8 says, that's a good point for me. The premium price, unfortunately, is what you have to pay to get a headphone jack, SD card, and a DisplayPort alt out all in one package. And that's, to me, that's what I feel we techies should care about. I don't care about the color of the phone. I don't care what kind of animations you have on the home screen. I really don't know if it's Oxygen OS or stock Android or any of these other things that are kind of aesthetic. What I care about is, did the manufacturer say it could do this? And does it do it better than another competing device? And if it does, I'll pay more for it. And I'll suffer shorter software support. And I'll suffer weird gremlins on the notification top bar on Sony's loves to duplicate. So like you'll be in the middle of one app and then you'll exit that app and you'll see two strips of your notification icons at the top. That's a bummer. That's ugly and it's dumb, and I wish Sony could fix it. But I don't care, because it's a phone that shoots 4K at 120 frames per second, and I can dump those files to a memory card in the phone, and I can work off that stuff so much more easily. A Sony becomes a production platform that fits in my pocket. And Nicholas is also saying the Xperia 1 are selling really well in the EU and Asia. Please do not skip our market. I don't think Sony's going to leave the EU right away, but what little room they have left in the United States, I think, is where it's going to leave first. Then, depending on units sold, the EU is their middle strategy. So they always launch first in Japan and China, and those phones sell like hotcakes in Japan and China. And then there's the bigger push, like a month later, there's the bigger push to move phones to the EU. And then like a month after that is when they would bring phones to the United States. So I think the EU is going to stick around a lot longer. But I don't think it's a guarantee that they're going to stick around forever. And I think at some point, maybe in the next 5 years, it could be Sony is just a division of phone that exists like Sharp, where it only sells in Japan. And maybe that's how it plays out. That is my aggressive prediction for how Sony might play this whole thing out.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at MeAudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, MeAudio.com, M-E-E-Audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at MeAudio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
Dr. Claw, that's pretty funny. Okay, we got to read this one. Dr. Claw says, the iPhone discourse reminds me of how this one car podcast called the BMW 3 Series a D-bag Camry, referring to its common sight on the roads. Yeah, I live in Southern California. No one looks at a BMW or a Mercedes and says, ooh, status, that person is successful and I would like to engage in copulation type activities with that individual. I love rolling up in my busted Nissan Versa. It's got a big dent in the front fender. I've always been the, I want to show up in ratty jeans and a busted hoodie and sit in the back of this party and just watch all of these Hollywood people kind of flirt with each other over what business deal they're going to do next. And then someone would come up to me and be like, so what do you do? They're like, oh, I work in casting. Oh, you work in casting? That's so interesting. And you're like, okay, well, you're fake AF and I know we're never going to be friends. One of my longest friendships was with a voice actor where we spent like hours talking about classic zombie movies at this party. And we were annoying our spouses because like we didn't want to leave the party because we'd met like someone who thought on the same wavelength. And it was like 2 weeks before he found out I worked in casting when he showed up at a casting. And I was like, oh, hey, what's going on, man? He's like, hey, I didn't know you worked here. And then we spent almost his entire session talking about zombie movies again. And it was like, that is a 1 out of 1,000 kind of friendship in Los Angeles. And so now I kind of apply that to almost everything else. Like, is this something that I would buy just to show people that I bought something that has the right label on it? Then F that thing. F it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to support it. So, yeah, Dr. Claw, that's hilarious. The D-bag Camry is definitely kind of appropriate. But same thing, like there's a certain class of Audi driver out here that carries a terrible reputation for being an aggressive and obnoxious driver on the roads. A DTNL, that's so interesting, is unironically something I use. I find most things genuinely interesting, like I know nothing and I love learning stuff. There is a distinct difference between someone just like actually engaged in a conversation and wanting to get to know you and someone who had completely written you off. And just like eventually like gets to a point where like, well, so what do you do? What do you work on? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I do commercial casting and I work in voiceover and stuff. And they're like, and then their whole demeanor changes. And now suddenly that I said something that could make them money. Well, now I really want to know everything about you and what's going on. And oh my gosh. What if I like dressed up to the nines and like gone in with like my flashy wingtips and like a really nice tailored suit and I was constantly doing my hair and stuff? Like playing that game is just so exhausting. And so I loved it. Was for me, it was the spectator sport of, I know a couple of people at this party. I'm going to hang out with them. We're going to talk about like horror films and stuff. And that's cool. Drink some really good bourbon. And then someone would invariably come in and be like, well, this guy is talking to those people who are sort of famous in animation. I wonder what he's up to. And their entire idea of who I was would change when they found out they could make money off of me. And it's very different, Aditya, than meeting someone who's like, I don't know, into collecting butterflies. I think that's ghastly. Tell me more. I want to know everything about your random butterfly collection and how do you acquire them and what do you do and how does this work? The showing a genuine interest in someone right from the go, that is completely different than, oh, here is someone I might be able to exploit for my own career. Hollywood. So, yeah, it's pretty messed up. So this last one, and our podcast is going to run a little bit long. This is written up over at Tech Radar by Timothy Coleman and kind of goes hand in hand. This was published after I published my look at the Samsung Galaxy camera versus the Vivo X100 article that's currently on Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. And Timothy's written up an article, compact cameras are making a comeback as demand for Nikon Coolpix soars by over 8,000%. And this is a trend that we've been watching play out in social media, in these little pockets of influencers saying, hey, did you know that there used to be standalone cameras and they take really interesting photos and they look different than the photos that come from our phone? And they have flashes on them so that you can get better lit when you're in a dark environment. And it's like this sort of discovery, and it's caused this kind of gold rush of Gen Z and Gen Alpha, like digging through their parents' old junk. Like, oh man, I was digging through like old boxes in my parents' garage and I found this old Canon, you know, this PowerShot, or this Nikon Coolpix, or a Sony CyberShot. So off the last round of articles that had come out about influencers, I was digging through some old gear and I found my Samsung Galaxy camera. So this was like a little mini Android tablet. It's got an old quad-core Exynos processor. It's running Android 4. It was never updated beyond Android 4. But it is indicative of what these sort of pocketable... I mean, this isn't huge. Do I have my... Okay. So this is what I put in my pocket for my Xiaomi 13 Ultra. And it's got the extra little protection on the camera sensors. And then I keep a lens cap on top of that. And I don't know if I can show this off in a good way. It's not, let me kind of rotate, pivot. There we go. I mean, it's a little bit thinner, but it's not dramatically thinner than putting a super zooming point and shoot camera lens in a back pocket. So this is indicative of what that experience would have been like. This is a 21 times zooming lens. I was really excited to find this and compare it against a phone because the widest focal length is the equivalent of a 23 millimeter focal length, which is the sort of field of view that we see from most of our phones. If you pick up a Vivo, the Vivo X100 Pro's main wide camera is around a 23 millimeter equivalent. So these two, when you shoot them side by side, give you a very similar field of view to start playing with, to frame and to compare the pros and cons of these different camera systems. So I wrote up the whole article and I've got photo samples just back and forth, all the differences. And I think it's kind of fascinating because part of the conclusion, to spoil part of that article on my Patreon, the camera hardware in a modern Ultra phone, maybe not a Galaxy Ultra, but like a Vivo, an Oppo, or a Xiaomi Ultra, is demonstrably better than anything we have on these old, like little point and shoot cameras. The main sensor on my Vivo is significantly larger than the main sensor here, and it shoots a much faster aperture. So this has a smaller sensor and a much smaller aperture than what the Vivo has. So it's the hole that goes into the camera, much, much bigger. I actually think it is better to have a collection of prime lenses on the back of a phone rather than trying to make zooming variable optics. So this has one sensor and a big lens so that you can go wide or you can zoom in. But this lens can't be big enough to keep a consistent aperture across that entire zoom range. And the optics are kind of soft in certain parts of the zoom range. So you get to the further end of your 21 times zoom, those photos are not as nice or as crisp as when you've got the phone kind of shooting wider open or that you stop down. So it's like part for part for part for part for part. What we can put in our pocket now dramatically outperforms the science, the technology, the hardware that we used to have in these little point-and-shoot cameras. So I just think it's really interesting, and I'd love to hear some feedback on this if you want to hit me up on comments. I posted this question across social media, on Mastodon and on Threads and on Blue Sky. Where are smartphone manufacturers going wrong? If I capture a RAW file from a Vivo X100 Pro, it looks so much better than any of the files I can generate from a 10 or sometimes even 20-year-old digital camera. but there is a certain quality to the photos that is now starting to attract attention from younger consumers. There is something happening. There's something going wrong with smartphone camera manufacturers. I think we're focusing on things that are scientifically impressive, but don't actually get photos more attention when we're sharing them on social media. Now, everything has become so HDR bright and unicorn pukey and colorful. Nothing really stands out unless it looks different than what our phones are all trying to accomplish. That's sort of in my brain is a loose way of trying to phrase part of what that other editorial is about. But if you want to see head to head, you know, self-portrait. You want to see like, you know, a landscape or colorful rocks or detail at maximum zoom. I'm telling you, like, it is remarkable how much better the phone cameras are. And I've gotten so many people saying like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, like the phone sensor is one thing, but you need the better optics. And like, well, if you have zooming optics, that's more complicated and not as it's harder to make a zoom look good across the entire zoom range. On an inexpensive zoom, you often hear like, hey, in this range, your photo quality gets a little bit soft or details get a little smeary, stuff like that. If you have four prime lenses on the back of your phone, you can get away with much simpler optics because nothing is zooming, nothing is moving around. So you can have a wider, faster aperture. You can have a clearer, just simpler light transmission directly into that sensor. Your in-between focal lengths won't be as crisp because you've got a crop zoom, but I can, like, I'm holding up my Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I can go from an ultra wide, which is even wider than my Galaxy camera, and then I can go up to around 100 millimeter equivalent focal length, and all of it looks better than what the Galaxy camera can do. In the article, I then point out where the advantages are on the Galaxy camera, so I'll leave that as the tease. If you'd like to see where a 12-year-old Samsung camera can outperform a modern-day smartphone Ultra, that's where you'll be able to subscribe to my Patreon. So let me kind of scale back here because we had a couple of comments and I want to get into these before we wrap up the show. Adichie, you know, same. That Samsung phone camera was something teenage me really wanted to own. So I have that, and then I also have the K-Zoom. So I'm not letting go of those. Those are fun, peak Samsung experimentation. It is actually, I mean, like, I might actually give the Galaxy camera to my daughter and just let her play around with it. And I'll be curious to see what she says, because the last camera she really took around and shot with was a Lumix G85. So I'm curious to see, like, will she have an opinion on a Micro Four Thirds camera with an interchangeable lens versus a point-and-shoot Samsung? Or will she just like, oh, look, you can zoom really far? I'm really curious. My 8-year-old daughter has a slightly more sophisticated eye, so if something like that will be noticeable. Diago Mora, isn't a super zoom shaped like an entry-level DSLR? The Galaxy is more of a point-and-shoot. So, yeah, I guess, but super zooming usually is sort of denoted as having around a 20-time zoom. So, from your widest focal length to your farthest focal length, once you start pushing into, like, 20x zoom, that's sort of where we bridge out from just a little point-and-shoot. When we're looking at the article, and they're talking about, like, this like cool pics that's on the screen, this is like a 5x zoom, or what is it? Oh no, this is a Nikkor 12x ultra wide. So it starts with a slightly wider field of view, but zooms 12x the focal length. So we have all these other like designators. We have point and shoots, and we have bridge cameras, and we have super zooms, and we have all this stuff. So like I did a lot of work with Kodak back in the day. And they had a bunch of super zooms where they would start at 20x zoom and then extend out to like 50x zoom. But you would still call the 20x zoom a super zoom. The reason it had a bigger lens wasn't because it zoomed more. It was because it had a bigger sensor that went with that zoom. So this has 20 times equivalent zoom as compared to a 35 millimeter equivalent sensor, but it's starting out with a smaller sensor, which gives it that farther reach, crop factor. So that's where I feel a lot of the point and shoot nomenclature fell apart. So you had DSLRs and now we have mirrorless cameras, and we don't talk about, you know, X crop zooms because you just talk about the focal range. What is the focal range of this lens? You don't say, oh, well, it's a 12 millimeter to 35 millimeter, so that's a 3x zoom. You would never buy a 3x zoom DSLR lens or a mirrorless lens. You would look at the focal range. So as point and shoots got more capable, we started coming up with other names to describe them. And often you'll hear people talk about like bridge cameras, and those are kind of supposed to be fancier, but do this and that. But we had point and shoots that could do things like shoot higher quality video and capture raw files. Well, those were more expensive point and shoot cameras. Then they became more expensive super zooms, 20 plus X zoom. And then we started talking about all these different features. So it got messy. But I remember people talking about one of my very first power shots, which looked like a little mini teeny baby DSLR, and how incredible the super zooming capabilities were on that Canon. I want to say it was the S2. And I think the S2 only had a 10x optical zoom. So again, it's sort of like, you know how people talk about flagship phones, but that doesn't mean anything? Point and shoot versus super zoom doesn't mean anything. It really doesn't. You can have a 400 millimeter equivalent lens on a camera. If you have a 100 to 400, well, you only have a 4x zoom. Is that a super zoom? I don't know. You can take pictures of craters on the moon, but it's not 20x zoom like on my pocket camera. Wah, wah. Oh, Ken X. Yeah, all it needs is an MFT adapter so we can use more lenses with it. I'm still really shocked and disappointed that like Xiaomi has their photography kit for the 13 and the 14 Ultras, but so few other companies have come out with like lens adapters or diopters or just mounts to put on ND filters. Like even that, just that alone would be a huge perk. From Dave Burns, I think that implies that the best-selling phones aren't competing with point-and-shoot cameras from 15 years ago. I also wonder if we see more people refuting constant phone usage. So that's definitely a part of it. And we were kind of talking previously, I don't know if it was last week, but just sort of some of the trend on people wanting to use like dumb phones and flip phones and stuff like that. And I think that's a part of it. There's like a deliberate action of, I am picking up this camera, and this camera is going to take a photo. And that's it. The camera is not going to distract me with notifications. The camera is not going to get in my way with like, you know, adverts for games. I'm going to take this photo. Then you won't see that photo until I can get the photo off of the camera somehow. And sometimes you could Bluetooth it over or use Wi-Fi or plug in a cable, but sometimes you just have to wait until I get home and then I'll share the photo with you. So I think there is something deliberate about that, where someone is making a statement to say, this is how I want to engage with capturing a moment and sharing that with my friends. But to your point, like a lot of people are saying like, oh, well, yeah, it's like this lens and that makes the image better. And you're like, no, it's not. The technical characteristics of a modern premium tier phone dramatically outpace the older point and shoot cameras. The decisions made in processing that photo, though, I think could be contributing to a photo that looks more interesting because it's not like every other unicorn puke bright HDR photo out there. And that I think is getting lost in the translation. Like if you go to like photography websites, it's a bunch of like at Petapixel and DP Review, it's a bunch of people patting themselves on the back like, yeah, we know regular standalone cameras would always be better than phone cameras. And you're like, that is so dumb. It's a bunch of people who hold on to gear for a really long time. So I totally believe it's like someone who's like, yeah, I still have my OnePlus 6 and that camera's terrible compared to my, you know, tens of thousands of dollars mirrorless camera. So who would ever use their phone camera? Blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no, you've missed it. You've missed years of photography improvement. And you're still talking about the phone as this compromised solution that is only acceptable if you have no other gadget to shoot with. I'm now putting photos and videos up directly against Micro Four Thirds. Like, it's gotten pretty aggressive in the pocketable space. And also, put that Sony A7 in your pocket and get back to me. DTNL, where are they going wrong? Offer more filters. The technical aspects are fine, but not for the mass consumer markets. Give folks a camera button, expandable storage that they don't need to delete, upload stuff to the cloud. Phone cameras are simply put more convenient and really good. Just make the UI simple to use, make the usage nicer, and possibly offer nice aesthetic filters. I think that's kind of a good sum up, Aditya. I think, again, I think we're losing sight of what are people trying to do when they capture a photo. I'm out at a park, it's a bright sunny day, take a photo of my daughter, there are like pine trees behind her. Do I want the pine trees to be as bright as my daughter's face? No. I want my daughter to stand out from a bright background in Southern California sunny light. And so that means I have to shoot raw and edit the photo and introduce more contrast and crush some of the shadows that are behind her in the trees and the leaves and the foliage so she stands out more from the background of the photo. That's what I care about in a composition, and I feel like that's one of the things that smartphone camera manufacturers are losing sight of. Oh yeah, Bray Gray, these things have been flying off shelves. Yep, there's an uptick on the vintage softer look, the Fuji X100s, the Ricoh GRs, the youth want the instantly stylistic JPEGs. Absolutely spot on with that. Fuji processing is so classic photo. I haven't shot on a Ricoh. I really need to get my hands on a Ricoh. Because I think that's also going hand in hand with a conversation that's happening in cinematography right now, where you're getting these incredible sensors on cinema cameras, and they're doing this incredible work. We're starting to expand dynamic range and better competing against film. But then you put these really sterile analytical lenses on the front, and yes, they are technically more precise, but the image doesn't look like film. And so instead, you start looking at these cinematographers that are finding old glass to put in front of these really, really analytical, dynamic range, impressive sensors, just to recapture some of the feel of what cinematography used to look like in like the 60s and 70s. And so that, I think, is this interesting battle back and forth, is like, we tried this era of cinema where we would shoot clinical and then try and use like software and filters to make it look more worn out or aged, or we want the imperfections of old glass. I cannot remember the YouTube channel now. This sucks. My brain is Swiss cheese. But I watched this video essay on someone who tried to recreate the look of The Ring, the American remake of Ringu. And the entire look of The Ring is almost completely captured in camera. That bluish greenish tint, the soft focus, the artifacts, the degradation, the look to the lighting, almost all of it was captured in camera. That means they had no safety margin. If they messed up a shot, it was game over. They would have to either reshoot or like they just wouldn't get that shot. And if you bake all of that color and softness and vignetting and optical characteristics directly into the shot, man, you better have an amazing team that can consistently carry you through an entire feature film. And this person went through and did, like, these are all the hoops I had to jump through to try and recreate the look of this film. And if he had done it perfectly, it would have been like thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to get it to look right. And then on top of, you know, film processing costs and stuff like that. But instead he was like, well, I found some things that were close and this is some stuff that was really adjacent. You could kind of move this back in here. And it was still an incredible effort to make it look in camera like what we see in the film The Ring, and not have to like do a whole bunch of post-production and color grading and work and everything else. Like, it is just, that is what the movie looked like. That's how the film was processed. Awesome, awesome stuff. And I'm glad to see that there's kind of like a return to this sort of idea, even though, excuse me, like a mass market superhero film is going to be shot with tons of coverage and lots of angles, and they'll just assemble the film in post, and then a bunch of CG artists will make the characters fight, and that's how that works. But you start getting into these other like dramas and period pieces and stuff like that, and it is such an interesting statement when someone takes a modern day camera, throws old glass and old filters on top of it, and captures a look and captures a feel that we couldn't have before, or that we couldn't just do with digital filters. I think that, again, broadly, I'm not putting all of that on Instagram influencers who are like, oh, look, my cool pics from 20 years ago, so much better than my iPhone. That's not true. But I understand the sentiment of, this is putting out a different photo that makes me the focus of the image in a way that's so much more interesting than what my phone is trying to do by making everything bright. Sorry. I'm behind on the chat. Yep, Diago Mora, I had a Canon with a 35x zoom. I think I had one of the 20x. I also had one of their like larger sensor. I forget, what was it, the PowerShot G? I can't remember. But like one of the other phones that's proving to be extremely popular in this whole revision is the SX series. And those were the cheaper, less feature complete Canons, but also had 20x zooms. So again, it's like kind of all over the place what we used to call these cameras. They're all point and shoot, but some of them had bigger lenses than others, and some of them fit better in your pocket. So, Carl Gunderson is asking, why did we go from millimeters to X zoom for phone camera zoom lenses? And unfortunately, I think it is because I think manufacturers correctly saw that if you were going to displace a part of the camera market, it was going to be the point and shoot. The pocketable cameras were going to be replaced by our pocketable phones, and those consumers were trained on X zoom. Like this article is showing a Nikon, and on the lens, I don't think I can make this any bigger. Hold on, let me try and zoom in the old-fashioned way, is Nikkor 12x wide optical zoom EDVR. And then it lists the actual focal length, 4.5 millimeters to 54 millimeters. But that's not the equivalent field of view of what we would expect from that camera. So what people cared about was, this is a Nikon with a 12x zoom. And that marketing speak and that mentality, I think, carried over into our phones. I think that's the through line. But as phone cameras have improved, now we're starting to see some of that pushback. Like on, like in Vivo's portrait mode, everything is now switching back over to millimeters and to aperture. So it's not just how strong or how weak the background blur is. It's measured in your apertures, just like Huawei used to do back in the day. And they're starting to describe the post-processing background blur as it relates to old classic Zeiss lenses. So I think some of that mentality is kind of coming back. If we expect that the phone can be a better contributor to content creation, then it matters that we talk about those tools in ways that relate to photographers and cinematographers. If it's only to replace the camera that fits in your pocket, then it's 12x zoom, 20x zoom, 10x, 5x, whatever. 0.6x zoom for the ultra wide. It's silly, but it's targeting a specific kind of consumer. Oh, Simon says, Hypno, I'm still impressed with it so much. That video from the Vivo X100 Pro looked phenomenal. It is such a good competitor, and it's arriving at just an astounding price for how good those cameras are. Oh, Ted's saying Fuji? Did someone say Fuji? Ted's our resident camera body snob in the Discord. It's a... hold on. No, Ted is all about like the more current and more modern cameras, but is it Jeremy that's into like film photography right now? I have to look that up. I'm sorry, I probably have the wrong members there. Yeah, Malik, you're telling me that old Panasonic point and shoots are coming back into style. I mean, In a way, yeah, there's a conversation bubbling right now about using dedicated cameras for this kind of stuff. Yeah, and Dave, my girlfriend makes scrapbooks because it creates a physical object the memory exists on, even if the digital is more readily available. And I've been doing that too. We've done a number of photo books for my mom and dad, just as like birthday and Mother's Day and Father's Day gifts. And it's like, we did one like grandparents during the pandemic. It was kind of an emotional book to put together, just like, oh yeah, there was all this stuff. And the first time we were brave enough to try a road trip, and so many memories were kind of packed into like that period of time. And it matters that it's like a physical thing. One of the best Christmas gifts that I ever did for my dad's side of the family, years and years and years ago, I took my Canon. I had a Canon 7D, and I took it to one of our big Christmas family reunions. I'm just shooting photos like all over the place. And I put them into a photo book and printed it out hardback. And I made sure I like got orders from all the family members, and I sent it out to everybody. And it was like a really big deal. About 5 years after that Christmas was one of the bad floods that hit New Jersey and New York. And my aunt lost all of her photos and literally started rebuilding her family photo collection on my photo book. Like, I have this one Christmas where all of the family was here and all of the cousins and all of the aunts and uncles, and this is what I'm starting with. And it was like, that was the first step in like recovering photos from other people and getting prints from other family members and shooting new photos at new family events so that she could rebuild everything. But she lost like decades of like film and negatives and stuff like that. So yeah, making some of this stuff like tangible, physical, printing it out matters. And even printing it out from a phone. I got a photo of one of the softball players at my daughter's last game, just cracking the ball. This little like pixie beast of a player. Her name's Ava. She's like this totally contained, kind of over everything little kid. You throw the ball at her and she barely like lifts her glove and just like snatches it out of the air. She's like 7 years old and she is an astounding athlete, but like she gets up to bat and she cracks that. And I managed to get that perfect like batter pose, end of her swing, ball flying off into the distance, like so good. So I'm going to print that out. I'm going to do a medium sized print and give that to the coach at the end of the season, because our coach is phenomenal. We have a really good softball coach. And just like a nice little thank you, right? It doesn't have to be a huge grand gesture or anything, but I shot that on a phone, has enough resolution to back it up. I can crop it, do a little bit of editing. I might throw it into black and white just to make it look artsy. And then it can be a gift. You will remember the 2024 girls softball season because we gave this to you, and I'll have all the girls sign the back. It'll be great, right? So anyway, it means a lot because it also shows that you put the effort into that. Yeah, Ted, it is Jeremy, is in his vintage camera body era, led to a golden period in the photography channel, creativity abounding. We do have a March challenge. The March challenge is self-portrait on the Some Gadget Guy Discord. And my self-portrait is horrific. You've probably seen it. But Ted has a couple self-portraits up that I think are looking really good. I'd be curious to see if Jeremy shoots one on film. And we don't have anyone else competing on this one. We had a lot of people participating for silhouette. But it'd be nice to have a few more faces in the self-portrait challenge. So it's, I don't know, I'm just saying. You can catch that on the Some Gadget Guy private Discord, which is attached to my Patreon at patreon.com/somegadgetguy. Oh, Dave, you totally should. Dave says, I should try one. I did not know that that was happening. Yeah, Jeremy set it up. So it's not even a me initiative. One of the members of the Discord was like, hey, I'd love to do some photography challenges to see if we can all improve our skills. And he went off and he's running with it. So if you would like to also participate, there's no prize or anything. It's not like we're judging these. It's just, it's nice to have another group of people that just want to get better at different styles of photography, and we're going to challenge ourselves to shoot some fun stuff. So yeah, Why don't we go ahead and wrap this up since I'm now at 2.5 hours. Lots of stuff coming up this week. There will be the public posting for the OnePlus 12 versus Pixel 8 Pro video. I'm probably going to do the public post for the camera versus phone comparison, the Galaxy camera versus Vivo X100 Pro comparison. And I've got some audio kit that I'm not sure I can talk about soon, but that might come out this week. I'm working with the PR on whether or not we can kind of launch some of that too. I'm just having so much more fun talking about using stuff than I am reviewing it. And I've been in kind of a dark place and kind of an angry place with like how PR has been working with influencers, how platforms have been handling videos and traffic. And like a couple times gotten really close to just like, maybe I'll just go get another job and just shut everything down and I'm done with social media and I'm done with being a reviewer or an online commentator or an influencer or whatever I'm supposed to be these days. So I really do appreciate conversation and the sharing and the support, but also just like really joining this to kind of share and highlight, hey, I made this thing. That matters so much more to me than just like, oh, I got a hot take. And I think that's exciting for a lot of other people because the entire ratchet of social media right now has gotten super toxic. You're not going to get as much traffic because, you know, social media companies only want like the ugliest, most divisive, arguing crap to be on their platforms because that keeps people engaged and on their site longer. But I think for the rest of us, like, if you're really a fan of technology, or if you're into this hobby, or if you're into photography, or if you're into music, or if you're just into talking about movies, lately there's been this kind of renaissance of sharing something that's cool. And it's okay if you don't think it's cool, I think it's cool, or you can just appreciate that someone has a passion for something that's not your cup of tea. That's what's been so much more fun to keep track of. That vibe has been so refreshing. To find little pockets of it. There's not a lot of it, but to find those little pockets of it has been so much nicer. A conversation like, what are all these kids doing with 20-year-old point-and-shoot cameras is so refreshing to talk about versus, I don't know, the HDRs on the iPhone are better than the HDRs on the Galaxy because iPhones get better SEO. So, folks, stay tuned. There's going to be a lot of stuff to talk about this week, and hopefully I can start sharing more of it soon. But yeah, I'll be stoked to share more than just like talk at you with more specs and press releases. So stay tuned. I want everyone out there to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I want you to keep taking care of yourselves so that you can continue to be the good tech neighbors that I know you are. I'll catch you back next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGG QA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love you all. And I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.